Sheila Graham Trott woke her teenage sons in the dead of night, tears streaming down her face. "I saw Kelly's face," she whispered. "She's hurt at Mark's Landing." At 2 a.m., the boys followed their mother onto a deserted coastal road in Indian Atlantic, Florida. Hours earlier, Kelly Brennan, a beloved nurse and close friend to Sheila, had disappeared. By sunrise, the bodies were there, Kelly's battered form exactly where Sheila imagined it in her dream. That vision launched a bizarre murder investigation. Sheila would later claim it was either premonition or confession. Prosecutors claimed it was premeditated violence. No murder weapon, no DNA ties, and no eyewitnesses. But the case came apart in court when Sheila's own words to her family and investigators pointed directly to her. Now she sits behind bars for life. Her sons testified against her. She maintains she didn't kill Kelly, only witnessed a killing in her mind's eye. So, if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Shattered Illusions. The sun rose gray and heavy over Indian Atlantic, Florida on February 16, 2010. The morning sky reflected the heartbreak of the beach below, a place soon to become a crime scene that would rupture a community. At 6:30 a.m., a Brevard County Sheriff's helicopter circled low, searching the dunes near Mark's Landing. Pilot John Coppola peered down and spotted something, a body. The shape was blurred by tangled branches and coastal brush, but unmistakable. He landed, jumping out, heart pounding, to find a woman's battered form, face down in the sand, her hair matted in the dirt. She'd been struck repeatedly, likely with a blunt object. And already, the tide was erasing her presence, mixing it with nature's quiet. The victim was identified as 46-year-old Kelly Brennan. She'd vanished less than 24 hours earlier in Indian Atlantic. A nurse by trade, a vibrant friend and loved one, affectionately called the Sarge by her colleagues. She had trained fellow nurses, guided patients through crises, and battled multiple sclerosis with courage and perseverance. Her sudden disappearance rocked the coastal. As she did it, Graham never had an answer. The memories of their mother's wild-eyed panic, her desperate insistence that Kelly was hurt, haunted him. At home, Sheila drifted in and out of rooms like a shadow, barely eating, sometimes crying, sometimes staring silently out the window for hours. The investigation builds. Detectives searched Sheila's car, her house, and her personal belongings. They found nothing, no blood, no weapon, no clothing that tied her to the murder. But they did find something else. Journals and notes, filled with confessions of pain, dreams about Kelly, and deep resentment toward Dan. They also uncovered cell phone records. On the night of Kelly's death, Sheila's phone had pinged towers close to Mark's Landing. There was a window of time, about an hour, when Sheila's location was unaccounted for. No one could place her at home. No one could confirm where she was. Prosecutors built their theory piece by piece. Sheila, motivated by jealousy, waited for Kelly at the beach. Kelly arrived alone, as she always did for her evening walk. The two women argued, maybe about Dan, maybe about something else. The confrontation escalated, and in a moment of rage, Sheila struck Kelly with a heavy object. Sheila then left the scene, disposing of the weapon and returning home to her sons, haunted by what she'd done. It was a compelling story, but it was still just a story. There was no physical evidence to prove it, only circumstantial clues and the chilling power of Sheila's dream. The grandmother's dilemma. Margaret Byers, Sheila's mother, became a central figure in the days after the murder. She had always seen herself as the family's protector, but now, faced with her daughter's unraveling, she was forced to make impossible choices. Margaret told the police everything she knew. She spoke about Sheila's visions, her fear, and her insistence that Kelly was in danger. She didn't sound like herself, Margaret admitted. She was frightened, lost. When pressed by the police, Margaret said, Sheila never spoke of hurting Kelly. She was worried for her. But Margaret's words did little to stop the legal machinery now moving against her daughter. The town on edge. The longer the investigation dragged on, the more unsettled the town became. The church put up prayer lists for Kelly and for Sheila's boys. The coffee shop down the street hosted tense, whispered conversations about the crime. Parents kept their children close, unsure if the violence was an isolated tragedy or a sign of something darker. Dan, now a public figure, for all the wrong reasons, stopped going out. He spent his nights fielding calls from lawyers and his days trying to comfort his sons. He admitted, privately, that he'd never imagined his mistakes would end like this. For the Trott family, there were no easy answers, only waiting, wondering, and the unspoken hope that the truth, whatever it was, might finally come to light. Chapter 4. The Walls Close. In winter faded along Florida's Space Coast, but for the Trott family, the darkness lingered. The state's case against Sheila grew stronger, not through any shocking new evidence, but through the slow, relentless tightening of details. Every inconsistency, every suspicion, every unguarded word she'd spoken in her confusion. Prosecutors build their story. Brevard County's district attorney's office was under public pressure to make sense of a case that felt both intimate and unsolvable. No one had seen Sheila with a weapon, no bloody clothes had turned up, no fingerprints matched, and the hammer, assumed to be the murder weapon, was never found. Forensics reports came back frustratingly clean, but prosecutors leaned on what they had: motive, opportunity, and the strange confession hidden in Sheila's midnight vision. They mapped out the triangle: Sheila's marriage, Dan's affair, Kelly's role as friend turned rival. They pointed to the messages between Sheila and Kelly, growing colder and more clipped as winter dragged on. They highlighted the timeline of that night: Sheila's unexplained absence, her nervous return, her son's testimony about her dream. A narrative emerged. This was a woman scorned, prosecutors argued. A wife unable to accept the loss of her husband and the betrayal of her friend. They argued that the vision wasn't psychic, it was memory breaking through guilt. The defense struggles. Sheila's legal team scrambled for daylight. Without hard evidence, they insisted, there could be no conviction. They painted Sheila as a heartbroken woman suffering from severe stress and mental confusion, not a killer. They called her dream a symptom of trauma, not a roadmap to murder. Expert witnesses testified about dissociative states, the power of guilt to twist memory, and how easily sleep deprivation could create hallucinations. Friends of Sheila described her as nurturing, incapable of violence, still wounded by Dan's affair and Kelly's perceived betrayal. But the jury watched the Trott sons, Graham and Creighton, recount their mother's behavior. The two boys, fragile and exhausted, told the court how their mother woke them in a panic, spoke of a body, and led them to the spot where Kelly was later found. Their story was simple, believable, and impossible to ignore. The courtroom drama. The trial began in late 2014. Journalists filled every seat. Kelly's friends sat on one side of the aisle, heads bowed, while Sheila's family clustered together, silent and tense. Sheila took the stand in her own defense. Her voice shook, sometimes barely rising above a whisper. "I loved Kelly," she insisted. "She was my friend. I would never hurt her. I don't remember anything. I only had the dream." Prosecutors pressed her, asking why her phone was near Mark's landing, why her stories shifted, why her son's testimony lined up so clearly with the timeline of the murder. Sheila grew more distressed with each question. "I can't explain it," she said. "I wish I could." The missing weapon detectives searched for the hammer in every nearby canal, marsh, and trash site. Volunteers waded through thick reeds, sifting through sand, hoping for a clue. But the murder weapon, like so many pieces in this case, remained missing. Prosecutors turned the missing weapon to their advantage. "Sheila is careful," they argued. "She planned this. She didn't want anyone to find the hammer. That's why she hid it. Why there's no blood, no prints." The defense fired back. "Or maybe there is no weapon because Sheila didn't do it. Maybe someone else killed Kelly. Maybe the true story is even stranger than anyone realizes." The son's testimony. Nothing hit harder in the courtroom than the testimony of Graham and Creighton. Both boys described that surreal, sleepless night, how they watched their mother unravel, how she seemed haunted by visions, how she insisted on finding Kelly in the dark. "We thought she was sick," Graham said, his voice tight. "She kept saying she saw Kelly's face. She was scared." The prosecutor asked, "Did you think your mother was capable of hurting Kelly?" Graham hesitated, eyes filling with tears. "I don't know what to think anymore." The words hung in the air, heavy as thunder. Media frenzy news vans lined the courthouse street. Cable anchors debated the psychic confession every night, some painting Sheila as a cunning murderer, others as a tragic figure lost in her own mind. National audiences were captivated by the strange story, how a dream had led police to a body, and how a mother's love and madness could be so intertwined. Reporters dug up every detail of Sheila's life. Old photos of her and Kelly at community events splashed across the news. Neighbors spoke of odd behavior, of changes in Sheila's personality after the divorce, of whispered arguments and cold silences. But no one could say with certainty who Sheila was anymore, a victim or a villain, a grieving friend, or a remorseless killer. The town's heartbreak. Indy Atlantic was never the same. Some people stopped speaking to the Trott family. Others left casseroles on the front porch and prayed for everyone involved. The church hosted special services for healing, but the sense of safety had vanished. Kelly's family grieved quietly, avoiding the cameras, but finding little peace. For them, justice meant closure, even if the whole story might never be known. The Trott boys, once cheerful and confident, withdrew. Their friends didn't know how to help. Dan, once the town's mayor, stayed home, haunted by regret and unable to fix anything for his sons or his former wife. The verdict looms. As closing arguments approached, both sides made their final pleas. Sheila Graham Trott acted out of jealousy and rage, the prosecutor intoned, voice ringing in the silent courtroom. She alone knew where Kelly was because she put her there. The defense spoke softly, urging the jury to see the doubt in every shadow, the uncertainty in every fact. "This is a tragedy, but without proof, you cannot send a woman to prison for the rest of her life." The jury left to deliberate, and Indy Atlantic held its breath. For Kelly's family, for the Trotts, and for a nation transfixed by a story stranger than fiction, the next hours would shape everything that followed. Chapter 5. Verdict. The courthouse in Brevard County stood quiet as the jury filed back into the room. It had been days of waiting, hours marked by pacing hallways, whispered prayers, and faces pressed against the cold glass of courtroom windows. Reporters lined the benches. The air was electric, everyone straining to catch the words that would decide the future. Sheila sat at the defendant's table, pale, her hands clasped tightly together. Her attorney leaned close, quietly repeating the phrase they'd practiced, "No matter what happens, stay strong." In the gallery, Graham and Creighton sat with their grandmother. Their father, Dan, stayed in on the last row, head bowed, eyes rimmed red. The jury foreman stood. His voice was soft but steady. "We, the jury, find the defendant, Sheila Graham Trott, guilty of first-degree murder." A gasp rippled through the room. Sheila's mouth fell open, and her whole body seemed to shrink inward. Her attorney touched her arm, but she didn't move. She looked to her sons, searching their faces for something she couldn't find. Maybe forgiveness, maybe hope. Graham lowered his eyes. Creighton bit his lip until it bled. Aftermath. The judge wasted little time. "Ms. Graham Trott, you are sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole." The words echoed in the large, echoing chamber, impossibly final. Sheila closed her eyes and nodded, almost as if she'd expected it all along. Dan left the room first, hurrying his sons outside before the press could swarm them. Reporters followed, snapping photos, thrusting microphones at anyone who looked their way. Someone shouted, "Did she ever confess?" But no answer came. The Trott family was silent, battered by public opinion and private pain. Kelly Brennan's family wept quietly. Her mother clutched a gold necklace that had once belonged to Kelly, rocking gently, her lips moving in silent prayer. For them, there was relief, but not peace. No one could ever bring Kelly back. Justice, even when served, felt cold. Life in prison, Sheila was transported to the women's prison in Ocala. The intake process was clinical and impersonal. She surrendered her wedding ring, her watch, every piece of the life she once knew. Her cell was small, with cinder block walls and a narrow window that caught only a sliver of sky. Sheila spoke little to the other inmates. Some recognized her from the news, and they watched her with curiosity or suspicion. She filled her days reading, writing letters she rarely mailed, and staring at the ceiling, reliving the night over and over. Sometimes, in the dark, she whispered into the emptiness, "I didn't do it." Other nights, she wondered if maybe, just maybe, her dreams had become reality without her knowing. The lines between memory and imagination blurred until she no longer trusted her own mind. The family fractures. Back in Indy Atlantic, the Trott family tried to rebuild. Dan moved into a new home, closer to his work. Graham left for college a year early, eager to escape the stares and the constant questions. Creighton grew quiet and withdrawn, spending long hours on his bicycle, tracing the same routes his father once rode with Kelly. They saw Sheila only rarely. The prison visits were awkward, the conversation stilted. Sometimes, all they could do was sit in silence and hold hands across the cold metal table. Margaret, Sheila's mother, kept fighting for her daughter's innocence. She wrote letters to lawyers, filed appeals, and held prayer vigils at the small neighborhood church. She refused to let go of the hope that one day the truth might come out, whatever that truth might be. Lingering doubts. Not everyone in town believed Sheila was guilty. Years passed, and rumors persisted. Some said another woman, someone jealous of both Kelly and Sheila, had done it. Others insisted the police had gotten desperate and pinned the murder on the most obvious suspect. Books were written, podcasts released episodes dissecting the case, examining the oddness of the dream confession. One reporter tracked down a former co-worker of Kelly's who claimed Kelly had confided fears about a stalker weeks before she died. The lead was never proven, but it kept the story alive in public memory. Some pointed to the missing hammer as a sign of doubt, or the lack of DNA evidence, or the simple improbability that a woman with no history of violence would suddenly snap. But the facts remained the same. Only Sheila led the police to the body. Only Sheila claimed to have dreamed of the exact spot where Kelly's life ended. Life moves on. Indy Atlantic changed. New families moved into the neighborhood. The cycling club disbanded. People remembered Kelly's laughter, her kindness, and her dedication to her patients. But the shadow of her death lingered. Sheila's former friends divided. Some visited her in prison. Others never spoke to her again. The church held an annual candlelight vigil for Kelly, each year a little smaller, but never forgotten. And still, every February, the local news would run the story again. Photos of Sheila and Kelly side by side, smiling at a community fundraiser, then separated by the gulf of what happened on that cold beach. The meaning of a dream. Years later, Sheila's sons tried to make sense of it all. Graham, now a father himself, sometimes caught glimpses of his mother's smile in his own daughter's face. He wondered, late at night, if he would ever really know what happened. Creighton rarely spoke of that winter, but on long rides, when the wind was at his back and the sun was bright, he would remember the mother who taught him to swim, who sang to him as a child, who led him, for reasons he'd never understand, into the heart of tragedy. The story became legend, the truth forever tangled in dreams and memories. In the end, justice had its verdict, but the questions would never go away. Chapter 6, Aftershocks. The world didn't stop for Kelly Brennan, and it didn't stop for Sheila Graham Trott either. The verdict was delivered, the courtroom cleared, and the Trott family scattered, each person carrying their own private earthquake. Yet as months became years, the case's aftershocks rippled through lives, memories, and even the law itself. Appeals and unanswered questions. Margaret Byers sat at her kitchen table every Sunday, a stack of legal documents by her side. She never let go of her daughter. She filed paperwork, contacted Innocence Projects, and wrote letter after letter to anyone who might listen. Editors, investigators, lawyers, church groups. Sometimes she would close her eyes and try to remember Sheila's face before it all changed. Bright-eyed, laughing, hands busy, in the kitchen. A new lawyer took up Sheila's case on appeal, focusing on the lack of physical evidence and the bizarre nature of the dream confession. They filed for a new trial, arguing that the case against Sheila was built on nothing but suspicion and coincidence. How can a woman be convicted because she saw a body in her dream? The lawyer asked in a televised interview. Where is the weapon? Where is the proof? The courts listened, but each time the appeals fell flat. The original verdict stood. There was no new evidence, and the jury's belief in the power of coincidence, of a mother's nightmare coming true, remained unchallenged. The Media Machine True Crime Podcast devoted whole seasons to the story. Documentaries were made with shadowy reenactments and grainy family photographs sliding across the screen. Some hosts cast Sheila as a wronged woman. Others painted her as a master manipulator. Reporters tracked down old classmates, neighbors, and fellow inmates. Everyone had an opinion. Some said Sheila was always a bit strange, always writing in her journal, always keeping secrets. Others said she was kind, quick to help, and absolutely incapable of violence. Kelly's family chose privacy over the spotlight. Her mother moved north to live with relatives. Her father stopped answering reporters' calls. But the name Kelly Brennan lingered in the air, on the hospital wing where she'd worked, in the cycling trail she loved, and in the nervous glances exchanged by anyone who remembered that winter. Life on the inside, Sheila learned how to survive behind bars. She kept to herself. She worked in the prison library, reading thick novels, legal texts, and the Bible. She wrote letters to Graham and Creighton, careful never to talk about the case, only about the weather or memories from their childhood. Sometimes she sang quietly at night, lullabies from when the boys were young. Other inmates sometimes asked about her case. "Did you really dream it?" they whispered. "Do you remember what happened?" Sheila never answered. Silence became her shield. She kept a small notebook, recording her dreams each night. Some were nonsense: flying over water, searching for lost keys, being chased by shadows. Others were darker: standing at the edge of the sea, looking for something she couldn't find, Kelly's face flickering in the waves. The Trot Boys, Graham and Creighton, each fought their own battles. Graham went through college quietly, majoring in engineering, dating only rarely. He kept to himself, answering questions about his mother with short practice lines. He never spoke of the night at Mark's Landing. Creighton, meanwhile, dropped out of college his first year. He took a job at a bike shop, working late hours, finding comfort in routine and the familiar hum of gears. Both boys tried to avoid the news each February, but the story always found its way back. Old classmates sent messages, sometimes supportive, sometimes cruel. Despite it all, the brothers kept in touch. Every few months, they drove out to Ocala to see Sheila. They talked about nothing and everything. Sometimes, Creighton asked if she remembered more. Sheila always shook her head. "Only the dream," she'd say softly. "Only the dream." In the Atlantic, after the town was forever changed. Some people moved away. Others put up thicker curtains. The park where Kelly once ran grew wild for a few seasons. The city, unable to find a caretaker. Gradually, the neighborhood shifted. New families arrived, unaware of the case that haunted every corner. But for those who remembered, trust became a little harder. The church held annual services for Kelly and for healing. Sometimes the pews were full, sometimes empty, except for Margaret and a few others. Candles flickered in windows each February, reminders that wounds linger. Ghosts. For Sheila, time became fluid, measured not by clocks, but by the passage of memory and regret. Sometimes she would close her eyes and picture her sons as little boys running on the beach. Sometimes she'd hear Kelly's laughter in her dreams, see her smile and wave, alive and untouched by violence. But when she woke, it was always the same: a hard mattress, a gray ceiling, and the distant clang of metal doors. She wondered in her quietest moments if she would ever know what was real, if she had truly been a witness to her own actions, or simply the victim of a mind broken by heartbreak and betrayal. In Indy Atlantic, Graham sometimes dreamed of his mother, of forgiveness, of explanations, of peace. Creighton dreamed of the ocean, always stormy, always pulling him farther from shore. Life moved on, but the aftershocks remained, echoing through every conversation, every family gathering, every dream. Chapter 7, Echoes and Endings. Years slipped by, quiet and relentless. Some wounds healed, others only scarred over. For the Trott and Brennan families, there would never be a full return to the world as it was before the night at Mark's Landing. But time, in its strange and patient way, forced everyone to find new ways to carry their pain. The weight of memory. Sheila Graham Trott grew older in her cell. Her hair went silver, her hands thinner, her eyes deeper. She lived by small routines, books shelved, letters written, prayers whispered at dawn. On rare days, a shaft of sun would cut through the tiny window and warm her face. She sometimes thought of that as forgiveness, or at least a kind of mercy. Each night, she recorded her dreams, trying to trap their slippery meanings. In these visions, Kelly sometimes appeared, untouched by violence, smiling beside the waves. Sometimes Sheila dreamed of her sons as children, Graham's laughter carrying across the water, Creighton's hand in hers. But there were nightmares, too, flashes of the beach, the cold sand, and her own voice crying out in the dark. Sheila never fully remembered what happened that night. Was it guilt or grief that led her to the truth? Or did some part of her truly know, even before the evidence surfaced? These questions haunted her, but she learned to live with them, the way one lives with a limp or a faded photograph. The Trott Boys. For Graham and Creighton, adulthood came slowly and unevenly. They struggled with trust of others, of themselves, of the stories families tell to keep themselves afloat. Graham finished college, got married, and became a father. He tried, with every part of himself, to build a home without secrets, to be the kind of parent who never let love turn sharp. But some nights, in the quiet, he'd remember the confusion of that winter, the car ride to the beach, the way his mother's voice trembled, the endless wondering. Creighton found his own path. He moved north, started fresh, found work in a marina, and spent his weekends out on the water, feeling most himself beneath an open sky. The memory of his mother, her songs, her gentleness, her mystery, remained with him. When the pain got too heavy, he rode his bike until his legs burned, and the community, then the tragic discovery, confirmed everyone's worst fears. Just a few miles inland, a very different scene unfolded in the Trott household. Their reality was unraveling in quiet but intensely emotional waves. Sheila Graham Trott lived in a tidy ranch-style home with her estranged husband of two decades, Dan Trott, and their sons, Graham and Creighton. Once, it had been a picture of suburban success. She, a Canadian-born real estate agent and swim instructor. He, the town's respected former mayor and now an airline pilot. Their children, thriving teenagers with bright futures ahead. But the calm exterior was a lie. Over the last 2 years, their marriage had fractured. Dan had moved out, joining a cycling club. Sheila had asked for a divorce, and soon after, she and Kelly were reconnecting. Sheila even described introducing Dan to Kelly, calling Kelly a ticket out of a bad marriage. It was meant as ironic, a relief, but soon became tragic. On the evening of February 15th, 2010, Kelly failed to show at her personal training session. Concerned, her roommate reported her missing. Meanwhile, at the Trot house, something alarming happened. Sheila began shaking uncontrollably. She was banging her head and muttering in panic. For a worried Graham and Creighton, it seemed like a seizure or worse. They called 911. Paramedics arrived, calmed her, conducted tests, but found nothing medically wrong. Sheila was sent home, but the shaking persisted, and Sheila became insistent. Kelly is hurt at Mark's Landing. In the dead of night, she roused her sons. To them, she looked fragile, like someone out of a nightmare, eyes wild, tears slicking her cheeks, voice broken. She spoke of a dream or a memory. She couldn't tell which. She saw Kelly's face. Graham would later testify. Everything was black. She was hurt the beach, Mark's Landing. Incredulous but worried, Graham and Creighton loaded her into the car and followed her to the highway. Their mother, trembling, insisted they needed to check the beach. Maybe it was a crazy, haunted vision or a real clue. Either way, they had to follow her. They drove south along A1A, headlights scattering into nighttime humidity and silence. They stopped at a turnout. Sheila's voice cracked. I think it's here. The boys stepped. World faded into wind and road. The brothers saw each other at holidays or when news from the prison reached them. They spoke of forgiveness, of their mother, of their father, of themselves. They knew that peace would always be an ongoing choice, not a destination. Dan and Margaret Dantrott's life never quite righted itself. He remarried quietly and kept his distance from Indy Atlantic's old social circles. He was a father to his sons as best he could, but there were words he could never say, apologies too tangled in grief and guilt. He spent long hours alone, remembering Kelly's laugh and Sheila's smile, how both were lost, each in their own way. Margaret, steadfast and fierce, became an advocate for prisoners' rights and mental health. She wrote op-eds, joined support groups, and never let anyone forget her daughter's name. She learned that justice, as delivered by the courts, could never answer all the questions left behind. Kelly's legacy, each February, Kelly Brennan's friends gathered at the shore for a silent walk. They shared stories about her fierce compassion, her quick humor, the way she never gave up on anyone. The hospital where she'd worked installed a small plaque in her honor. Nurses told new hires about Kelly's spirit, about the cost of kindness in a world that sometimes turns cruel. Kelly's mother, in the privacy of her living room, lit a candle each night. Sometimes she forgave. Sometimes she raged. Mostly, she just missed her daughter and the ordinary days they'd never have again. The town moves on. Indy Atlantic changed and changed again. The park grew lush. The old cycling club was replaced by a new one. And the stories of what happened faded, except in the memories of those who lived through it. For a while, the story of Sheila and Kelly and the dream murder was a cautionary tale. But, as with all stories, time blurred the edges. Tourists visited the beach, unaware of its history. New families moved in, bringing laughter back to quiet streets. But in some houses, when the wind rattled the windows just so, people still remembered. A question that remains. In the end, the story remained unsatisfying for anyone seeking simple answers. Was Sheila guilty or innocent? Did grief open the door to memory, or did guilt masquerade as vision? No court, no jury, no family could say for certain. What survived was not certainty, but a deep, echoing ache, a reminder that sometimes the line between dream and reality is too thin to see, and that, in the absence of proof, we must find our way forward, not with answers, but with acceptance. for the families left behind, for the sons who grew into men, and for the woman at the center of the storm, life was a matter of holding on to what was good and letting the rest be carried away by the tide. Out ahead in the coastal scrub was a dark, motionless form in spandex athletic gear, heart racing and already terrified. They didn't know at first what they were witnessing. Creighton, I saw a shadow of a body, a woman in workout clothes. They backed away. They didn't call the police. Instead, they drove home in silence. The image haunted them. The limp figure, underbrush, unseen fear. In their kitchen, under dim lamplight, Graham's girlfriend watched them, stunned. They were pale, distant. They argued briefly, we should have called 911. The boys agreed. But later that morning, their grandmother, Margaret Byers, arrived, summoned by a frantic phone call. Sheila was curled in fetal position on her bed, shaking. Not convulsing, but terrified, repeating, Kelly's face, Mark's landing. Margaret, alarmed and confused, dialed 911 again, the dispatcher. Your daughter said she killed someone? Margaret, she thinks she might have hurt Kelly at Mark's landing. That call triggered a sweep of officers to the Trotts house. As night bled into morning, the missing person report, the frantic phone calls, the mother's screams, all pointed to something sinister. While authorities were still racing to connect dots, Kelly's body had already been seen. Police homed in on the Mars landing location. It was exactly where Sheila had said it would be, even though she insisted none of it was real. She pleaded, I did not kill Kelly. Her words echoed in court recordings and garnered national attention. Reporters called it a dream murder. Headline, a woman who led her sons at 2 a.m. to a body she said she didn't kill, but saw in her sleep. Sheila's family background drew attention. Her mother recalled her daughter as free and bright, a swimmer who loved Canadian lakes and was happiest diving through Penetanguishene Bay's rock formations. That woman seemed far removed from this terrifying tableau of outrage. Dan Trott, the former mayor and pilot, was now a central figure in the tragic geometry. His affair with Kelly, which had sparked divorce, now became the main motive, said investigators. Jealousy, betrayal, rage. Prosecutors painted a portrait of a calculated crime. No weapon found, no DNA trail to Sheila, no eyewitnesses. But the dream, the Brenda trip, the letters, all pointed to her involvement. Sheila's defense peaked here, too. Her attorneys and public defenders argued that the entire investigation rested on the flimsiest of evidence. No fingerprints, no murder weapon, no DNA. The only proof was a dream and her own words. Todd Derritani, her first defense attorney, said, this is a dream case. Still, prosecutors found other threads. Bloody divots in the grass, traces of Kelly's blood in her own SUV's passenger floor mat. Witnesses claimed they saw a woman in light clothing entering Kelly's home that night, not a man. These scraps built a circumstantial chain that investigators said tied Sheila to ambushing Kelly on her lawn, hiding in shadows until she arrived, then striking mercilessly with a hammer. No direct physical evidence, but the scene, the broken home, the bruised illusions, it all pointed to a domestic homicide, the investigators said. The dream, they called it a ploy. Sheila called it a gift. The case hinged on those intimate moments. A mother leading two teenage sons to a murder scene at dawn under the influence of a vision. A grandmother calling cops to rescue a daughter she feared had lost her mind or done the unthinkable. And somewhere in that swirl was Kelly, a nurse, a friend, a life undone. She'd gone kayaking with Sheila not long before, bonded by humor, shared memories, and long sprees talking about life. Now her friendship was twisted into tragedy. In the coming days, a missing persons bulletin would close. A murder investigation would open wide. The Trots' lives would implode. A courtroom would emerge, and a mother would be forced to walk a courtroom aisle under the weight of her words and her dreams before a jury of strangers. Chapter 2, The Anatomy of Betrayal. By the time the sun set on that tragic February day, Indy Atlantic was buzzing with whispered theories and anxious stares. No one in the quiet Florida beach town could imagine how the private pain of a crumbling marriage would erupt into national headlines. Yet, for those closest to the triangle, Sheila, Dan, and Kelly, the truth was a mosaic of loyalty, heartbreak, and secrets. The fracture Sheila and Dan Trott had built their life like so many others. A home, two sons, shared dreams, and inevitably shared disappointments. Their marriage had survived nearly two decades of highs and lows, with roots reaching back to their college days and a mutual love for adventure. Dan, ambitious and charismatic, built a reputation as a town leader, first as an airline pilot, then as a respected mayor. Sheila, a Canadian transplant, was known for her athleticism, warm energy, and unwavering devotion to her family. On the outside, they looked like the embodiment of success. But what no one saw were the slow leaks, resentments over missed birthdays, long stretches apart, and the crushing realization that they'd grown into different people. By 2008, the gap was too wide to bridge. Dan, seeking camaraderie and perhaps escape, took up cycling with a local club. That's where he met Kelly Brennan. Kelly, the third side. Kelly was vibrant, quick-witted, and nurturing. She had overcome her own battles, fighting through multiple sclerosis, building a respected career as a nurse, and becoming a confidant to many in her circles. Her laugh filled any room. Her kindness, especially to those in pain, was legendary. When Kelly joined Dan's cycling group, their friendship seemed innocent at first. They shared early morning rides, stories of hardship, and a longing for something simpler than the messy realities of middle age. But what began as friendship deepened, inch by inch, into something more intimate. Texts turned into confessions. Lingering glances became late-night calls. Sheila, perhaps sensing the shift, tried to reframe the loss as liberation. She joked with friends that Kelly was her ticket out, a way for both women to escape situations that no longer served them. In reality, the pain cut deep. Sheila still loved Dan, and even if she didn't, the betrayal stung. Cracks become chasms. The Trott household grew colder. The boys, Graham and Creighton, noticed the chill in their mother's voice and the distant stare in their father's eyes. Arguments flared behind closed doors. Money was tight. Emotions tighter still. Sheila cycled through anger, sorrow, and a brittle kind of acceptance. Dan moved out. Sheila tried to start anew, but reminders of her former life haunted every room. Kelly, too, faced the storm. She confided in friends about the guilt and excitement tangled up in her relationship with Dan. She worried about Sheila, but couldn't help herself. Love, at times, is mercilessly complicated. It was only a matter of time before the town caught wind of the affair. Some friends distanced themselves, others took sides. But through it all, Sheila and Kelly maintained a strange, fragile peace. There were emails, sometimes friendly, sometimes tense. There were accidental run-ins at the grocery store, forced smiles at community events, and endless nights replaying what went wrong. The days before, as February 2010 began, Kelly was struggling. She'd recently helped a friend move, and her multiple sclerosis had flared up, leaving her exhausted. She still kept up her routine, work, cycling, and time with Dan. Sheila, meanwhile, seemed more anxious than ever. Friends noticed her jumpiness, her sudden weight loss, and the way her conversations often circled back to Kelly and Dan. On the surface, Sheila appeared to be coping. She attended her son's swim meets, volunteered at local events, and tried to move on. But her private journals, later entered into evidence, revealed a different story: jealousy, rage, sleeplessness, and dark dreams. On February 15th, Kelly went missing. The search began quietly, with concerned friends and colleagues making calls, then expanded into a full-scale investigation when her car was found abandoned near the beach. That same night, as detectives pieced together Kelly's last movements, Sheila was unraveling at home. She shook uncontrollably, her thoughts scattered. Her sons watched in confusion and terror as she muttered about nightmares and visions. The dream. At the heart of this case lies one of its most perplexing mysteries, Sheila's dream. She told her sons she had seen Kelly, hurt, alone at Mark's Landing. Was it a guilty conscience, a psychic vision, or a calculated ploy? Graham would later testify about that night, his voice shaking on the witness stand. She was almost in a trance. She kept saying Kelly's name, that she was in trouble. Creighton remembered Sheila's insistence. "We have to go, now. I need to see. I need to be sure." The boys, torn between fear for their mother and concern for Kelly, followed her through the silent streets. When they arrived at the beach, Sheila's reaction was visceral. She dropped to her knees, sobbing. They didn't see Kelly, clearly, that night, but Sheila was adamant something horrible had happened. Back home, the family's confusion only deepened. Sheila alternated between panic and catatonia, sometimes retreating to her room, sometimes pacing the house. When her mother, Margaret, arrived in the early hours, she recognized her daughter's state as something new, something darker than stress or grief. Margaret, fearing for both Sheila and the missing woman, made the fateful 911 call. She repeated her daughter's words to the dispatcher. "She says she killed someone. She says she killed Kelly." The investigation tightens. With that call, law enforcement zeroed in on the Trott family. Officers questioned Sheila and her sons, gathering details about the night's events. The boys' accounts matched. Their mother was distraught, insistent, and spoke of a vision. Detectives noted every word, every gesture. Dan, pulled in for questioning, was torn between shock and guilt. His affair was now public knowledge. He admitted to detectives that he and Kelly had been together, that he had told Sheila about the relationship, and that the breakup had been messy. Still, he insisted, Sheila would never hurt anyone. But as investigators dug deeper, inconsistencies emerged. Sheila's timeline was hazy. She couldn't remember when she last saw Kelly. Friends reported seeing her near Kelly's apartment the night she vanished. Security cameras showed a vehicle resembling Sheila's near the scene. Still, there was no physical evidence, no murder weapon, no blood on Sheila, no DNA. The only thing tying Sheila to the crime was her own confession, if it could be called that. A dream, a vision, a mother's midnight ramblings. But for prosecutors, it was enough to keep looking. Motive was there. Jealousy, betrayal, a broken home. Opportunity existed. Sheila's whereabouts were unaccounted for at key times. Means? The wounds on Kelly suggested a personal attack, a crime of passion. The town reacts. As news spread, the community recoiled. Neighbors who once waved to Sheila now crossed the street. The boys, once popular and outgoing, withdrew from friends and classmates. The Trot House was besieged by reporters, flashing cameras, and whispered accusations. Some believed Sheila was innocent, a grieving woman broken by betrayal. Others saw her as a calculating killer, hiding behind her family and feigned confusion. The truth, as always, was tangled in the spaces between. The stage is set, with Kelly's body found and Sheila in the spotlight. The story moved from the sand and surf of Indianatic to the fluorescent lights of the police station, and soon, the courtroom. Detectives assembled timelines, gathered witness statements, and prepared for the storm to come. In the middle of it all were two boys, once shielded by their parents' love, now asked to recount the worst night of their lives, and a mother, trapped between memory and reality, unable or unwilling to say what really happened on that fateful night. As the investigation deepened, secrets would unravel, alliances would shatter, and the thin line between dream and reality would blur even further. Chapter 3, Into the Shadows. In the days following Kelly Brennan's murder, Indianatic no longer felt like the quiet beach town it once was. Reporters clustered at the edge of yellow police tape, their voices hushed and urgent. Local parents whispered as they walked their children to school. The simple, sun-washed community was caught in the glare of national headlines, and the Trot family stood at its center. The search for answers. Detectives worked around the clock, piecing together Kelly's final hours. They reconstructed her day with painstaking detail, morning routines, text messages, gym visits. She was last seen by friends leaving her apartment around dusk. Security cameras from the area captured her car, a dark SUV heading toward the beach. There was no sign of a struggle at her home, no broken windows, no forced entry, nothing to suggest she'd been taken against her will. But the calm of her departure only made her murder more chilling. The medical examiner would later confirm she died from blunt force trauma, likely caused by repeated hammer blows to the head. The violence shocked everyone who knew her. Kelly was strong but gentle, and the attack had been sudden and merciless. Detectives focused on two things, motive and opportunity. Jealousy is a powerful fuel, and they knew about Dan and Kelly's affair. Sheila's name quickly moved to the top of their list. Yet, with no murder weapon and no eyewitnesses, the case was far from clear. The dream as evidence. The story of Sheila's dream spread quickly. To some, it was evidence of guilt, a subconscious confession. To others, it was a sign of a woman unraveling, crushed by the loss of her friend and the collapse of her marriage. At the station, investigators pressed Sheila for answers. She looked exhausted, her hands trembling in her lap. Her attorney advised her to remain silent, but Sheila spoke anyway. She insisted she loved Kelly, that she would never hurt her. The dream, she said, came out of nowhere. A black space, Kelly's face, the beach at Mark's Landing. But detectives weren't convinced. They wanted details. Did you see Kelly that night? No. Did you go to Mark's Landing? I don't know. Maybe in the dream. They pressed harder, but her answers became more confused, not less. They left the room, wondering if Sheila was hiding something or if she was simply broken by grief. A community divided. News of Sheila's arrest sent shockwaves through the neighborhood. Some neighbors rallied to her side, convinced the police had the wrong woman. "Sheila would never hurt anyone," said a friend from her swim club. "This is all a terrible mistake." Others weren't so sure. They pointed to the bitterness of the divorce, the whispered arguments, the strange tension between Sheila and Kelly that had started months before the murder. "She was jealous," said one acquaintance, voice low. "She couldn't let go of Dan or Kelly." The local press ran both narratives, and online forums lit up with theories. Was Sheila a cold-blooded killer or a scapegoat for a crime that someone else committed? A family torn. As investigators dug deeper, the true impact of the crime landed hardest on the Trott sons. Graham and Creighton were suddenly old enough to see the world's sharp edges. Their lives were reduced to interviews, attorney meetings, and police station waiting rooms. Friends stopped calling. Teachers didn't know what to say. The boys clung to each other, trying to make sense of what they'd seen that night on the beach. Graham, the older brother, felt responsible for his mother, for his younger brother, for a family that had fallen apart in the span of a few hours. In private moments, Creighton sometimes asked his brother, "Do you think